Where do you think you will be 10 years from now? What do you think your life will be like 10 years into the future? What will be your circumstances? How should we prepare to advance another decade? What should we expect? It's important for us to learn lessons as we progress through life, but we also find ourselves continually planning, thinking about, making preparations for the future. We learn lessons, we apply those lessons, but you know, it's like they say, as far as learning lessons from the past is concerned, you can't drive a car by looking in the rearview mirror. You have to look ahead. You have to look forward. We have to make plans for our future. So where do you think your life will be 10 years from now? One way to try to picture 10 years into the future is to maybe look 10 years back. What was your life like 10 years ago? And is today the future that you imagined at that time? Now, maybe 10 years ago, you were in the first or second grade. And the coolest thing in the world to you was riding a bicycle down a hill real fast. Or helping your mother make cookies. The last 10 years, in that case, may have seemed to have gone by very slowly because, well, that's pretty much all your life. But now, let's say you're in your mid-teens, and you have a very busy and important decade ahead. Life in these next 10 years will open up a whole world of possibilities. Education, career, marriage, family, homes, cars, travel. What do you have in mind? Any number of things I'm sure that you would like to do. Now, to me, the last 10 years have gone by very quickly. In fact, it's been scary fast. It's been so quick that it's hard to understand or to realize that that time has passed so quickly. And it makes it a little bit more worrisome to an old guy to look forward to the future. Now, I can kind of imagine my grandchildren being 10 years older. Our grandchildren being 10 years older. The oldest of our grandchildren by that time will have finished high school, possibly on into college or whatever his future will hold for him. And even the youngest, our little 5-year-old granddaughter, will be in her mid-teens. She's going to start kindergarten. So in 10 years, she will have finished 9th grade. And I can kind of imagine my grandchildren, our grandchildren growing older, because we've seen that. We've witnessed children growing up. But I've never been this old before. And it's hard to project myself another 10 years into the future. That will put me into my early 70s. I don't know what it's going to be like to be elderly, except that I'll get to go first in line at those potlucks. But there are things about the future that are really kind of uncomfortable to think about as we think about time passing. The title of the sermon this afternoon is The Time of Your Life. Life is measured in years and defined by time. And your future is coming. Whether you're 15 or 85, your future is coming. It will get here one day at a time. Each day is a building block for your future. How should we use that time? How should we plan? You know, most of the time, life just seems routine, and we take it for granted. We go from one day to the next, and one day is kind of like the day before and the day that will follow. But it all adds up to some pretty significant change. So what approach should we take as we look ahead to give thought to and make plans for the future. Today I'm going to suggest to you three fundamental concepts that we can keep in mind as we make our plans for the future. I want to begin in Ecclesiastes 11. Ecclesiastes, the 11th chapter. Ecclesiastes, of course, is written by Solomon, apparently toward the end of his life. Solomon was a man that God gave great wisdom to, but he managed to not use that wisdom effectively, at least at certain stages of his life. But as he reached the end or the closing years of his life, he became contemplative and he wrote this book. And in it, he has some thoughts to share with young people. Ecclesiastes 11, verse 9, says, "Rejoice, O young man, in your youth, and let your heart cheer you in the days of your youth. Walk in the ways of your heart and in the sight of your eyes." Basically, Solomon is saying, enjoy being young. Dream big and pursue those dreams. Go after what you find in your heart and put those thoughts, those ideas, those dreams into action. I think it would be pretty difficult to imagine a young person who doesn't have dreams and hopes and plans for the future. And Solomon is encouraging young folks to think in those terms, to walk in the ways of your heart and in the sight of your eyes. But he also adds this thought, but know that for all these things, God will bring you into judgment. Now, I don't read that as a threat. I don't think that Solomon means that God is going to punish you for the choices that you make. However, it is something to keep in mind because the choices that you make in your youth will affect you when you are older. They will have consequences, good or bad. The choices you make when you're young will be something that you will answer for when you are older. And so the thought here is that, okay, you have dreams, you have ideas, you have things you want to do and accomplish. Go for it. Do those things, but keep God's way in mind because the way you make those choices will have a big impact on the life that you will have. Verse 10, he says, "Therefore, remove sorrow from your hearts and put away evil from your flesh." So, again, the implication here is to make choices carefully, to pursue dreams, to think big, but be careful about what those choices are. Don't choose a way that is evil. Don't choose a way that is harmful. Don't choose a way that will lead to sorrow. But enjoy it while you can, he says, for childhood and youth are vanity. Now, in this case, I think the word vanity means temporary. It's a short period of time during which you will be young. And soon those days will be over. So live them carefully, thoughtfully. Follow your dreams, follow your heart. But remember that God holds us all accountable for the choices that we make. He goes on to say, remember now your Creator in the days of your youth. Remember God, learn about God now. I'm often reminded of the verse in 2 Timothy 3 where Paul writes to Timothy and says that you have known from childhood the scriptures that lead to salvation. Young people in our congregations have that incredible opportunity to have grown up understanding and knowing what God has in mind for you. So remember the Creator now in the time of your youth, before the difficult days come and the years draw near when you say, I have no pleasure in them. I guess that's Solomon's way of giving me the same advice that others have. Don't get old. I'm not sure how that works, but that's the advice I've gotten from many folks. Life is more difficult sometimes at the end. So enjoy life when you have that energy, when you have that those dreams, when you have those opportunities. Take full advantage of them. So we have our dreams, we have our hopes, we have our aspirations, and that applies if we're, again, as I said earlier, whatever age we're at. We all have plans, we all have hopes. There are things we want to accomplish, things we want to see and do. So let's ask the question again. What approach should we take, all of us, as we plan ahead to the next 10 years of our lives? Now, I'm asking you to consider a period of 10 years, not because I'm predicting anything's going to happen in the year 2023. That's not my point. I've chosen a period of 10 years because it's a short enough span of time that we can identify with it, but it's a long enough span of time that a great deal will happen. Much will occur over the course of a decade. As I continue, I also have one other assumption to make, and that is that we will continue in God's way of life. That as we make our plans, even as Solomon says here, that we will consider and remember our Creator. That we will put evil out of our lives. That we will make God's way of life the center of our choices and the way that we will continue to live. Now, I suppose history would tell us that in a period of 10 years, if we look back 10 years, there are some who are no longer part of God's church from 10 years ago. But you see, that's a whole different issue. That's a whole different subject. I'm approaching this afternoon based on the assumption that we will continue in God's way of life. And as we do that, as we continue in our pursuit of His kingdom and living in the way that He would have us live, how do we make plans for the future? As I said, I have three suggestions for you to keep in mind. The first one is that as we think about the next 10 years, we should remember who is in charge. Remember who is in charge. Turn back with me to James 4. My heart skipped a beat when Mr. Lutz turned to James 4. We're going to read a little further in the chapter than he did. James 4, verse 13. It says, "Come now, you who say today or tomorrow we will go to such and such a city, spend a year there, buy and sell and make a profit. Whereas you do not know what will happen tomorrow." There's a warning here that has to do with how we approach making plans in our lives. It's not that we're not supposed to make plans. You really have to have a plan if you're going to accomplish anything. You can't just wake up each morning and let the day happen. You have to have some things that you have set out to accomplish, that you are wanting to do. So we need to have plans. James is not here saying that we shouldn't make plans. The warning here is against one who is arrogant and independent of God. Of one who makes plans on his own schedule without taking God into account. God has given us a great deal of responsibility. He's given us free will. He's given us an independent mind. And He expects us to use that to accomplish things. Remember those parables, the parable of the pounds, the parable of the minas? The servants were given certain resources, and the expectation was they would take those resources and do something with them. That requires thought. That requires planning. That requires effort. That's what God expects of us. But as we make those plans, we must remember that we do not act independently of God. God is ultimately in charge. And God has a plan that is bigger than our plan. We make our plans. There's nothing wrong necessarily with being in some kind of a business where you're going to go someplace and buy and sell and make a profit. But it should be done recognizing that God's will takes precedent. That God's will in our lives is what we must always be subject to. For what is your life? It is even a vapor that appears for a little time and then vanishes away. I always think of a cup of coffee when I read that. You have a cup of coffee in the morning, nice and hot, and a little bit of steam coming off the top, and it's gone. That's about what life is like, at least from God's perspective, that we are just momentary in terms of our existence. It is our lifetime, so it's all we have. But our life is something that really is something that God has given to us, and we are subject to Him as we conduct ourselves. And so we have no authority over God. He is the one whose plan will take precedent over ours. Instead, verse 15, we ought to say, if the Lord wills, we'll live and do this or that. We recognize that God's will is what's most important, and that God's will is going to be accomplished. Jesus taught his disciples to pray, "Thy will be done." As we pray, we look for God's will to be accomplished in our lives. And as we set our plans, based on the assumption we made a moment ago, we're making our plans based on things that we think God would approve of, that would be within what He has in mind for us. Turn back to a couple of Proverbs here and look at a principle. Proverbs 16, verse 9. Proverbs 16, verse 9, says, "A man's heart plans his way, but the Lord directs his steps." We make our plans. We have goals. We have things that we, as I've said, would like to accomplish, would like to experience, would like to see, would like to do, would like to have. And within God's law, those goals can be perfectly acceptable. But the Lord directs his steps. Two ways we can look at that. First of all, we do make choices within God's law. He's directing our steps, the kind of choices we make. Our choices are more limited than others because we choose things that are within God's way of life. And another way to look at that is that as we make our plans and set out to do the things that we'd like to accomplish, we acknowledge that God is the one who's really going to decide if that's how it's going to go. God is the one who will make that decision, and we submit our will to His. So as we make our plans, we're going to be a whole lot less frustrated, and we'll be more in flow with what God has in mind if we make our plans with Him in mind, that we yield our will to His. And He will, if we look for Him to do so, then He directs our steps. Proverbs 19, verse 21. Proverbs 19, 21. That says the same thing in somewhat different words. Proverbs 19, 21. There are many plans in a man's heart. There are a lot of things that we would love to do, that we would like to be part of our lives. That maybe takes some, maybe won't happen now, they'll happen in the future, but they're plans or ideas, the things we'd like to accomplish. There are many plans in a man's heart. Nevertheless, the Lord's counsel, that will stand. So as we make our plans, we must remember who is in charge and recognize that we are submitting ourselves to His will. We should express and we should act on that initiative. We should be, in a right sense of the word, ambitious and planning things that we want to be part of our lives. But we recognize that it is in God's hands ultimately. One more thought along this line back in Hebrews chapter 12. Hebrews, the 12th chapter. As we noted in the book of James, the plans that we make are really subject to God's will. That everything we plan is not likely to happen in just the way that we thought it might. God has very much a role in the development of His plan in our lives. We read Hebrews 12, beginning in verse 5, most of which actually is a quote from Proverbs 3. But we'll read it here in Hebrews. It says, "You've forgotten the exhortation which speaks to you as sons. My son, do not despise the chastening of the Lord, nor be discouraged when you are rebuked by him. For whom the Lord loves, he chastens and scourges every son whom he receives." Now, there's some pretty strong words in that verse. Scourging, rebuking, chastening. God works in our lives to develop us in a way, since we're yielding to him, to develop us in a way that will allow him to include us in his family. That's his greater will for us. It says not to despise the chastening. In the margin it reads discipline. Don't despise the discipline that God will administer in our lives. The word discipline has two meanings. First of all, it means to teach or to instruct. Much of the discipline that we receive is a matter of what we learn. We can learn that from any number of ways. We can learn it from reading. We can learn it from being taught verbally. We can learn it from our own experience. Discipline means to be taught or to be instructed. Discipline also means to punish. There are times when our parents punished us. And as it says here in this chapter in Hebrews, they did it because they love us and they want us to not hurt ourselves. And so there were times when instruction wasn't enough, had to go another level to punishment or to actually correct a problem. We are told here that we must be patient and accept God's hand in our lives. Because sometimes the plans we lay out for ourselves are going to fall short. Things aren't going to happen in just the sequence that we had in mind. Not everything that we wish for or plan is going to come about, because God is the one in charge. His will is what will take precedence over ours. Dropping on down then to verse 11, no chastening, no discipline, being talked to or instructed sometimes can be just about as painful as a physical discipline. But no chastening seems to be joyful for the present. It's painful. Nevertheless, afterward it yields the peaceable fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it. So we see God's will in our lives is to bring about a positive result, will bring us and help us to be part of his family. Verse 12, therefore, strengthen the hands that hang down and the feeble knees. That's a word picture that describes someone who is discouraged. You know, shoulders are slumped and hands just kind of dangling there, and the legs, the knees are weak. God's chastening, God's discipline, God's presence in our lives will help us to become stronger. Verse 13, so those weaknesses are strengthened. And it says, verse 13, make straight paths for your feet so that what is lame may not be dislocated, but rather healed. God will use the circumstances in our lives to teach us and at times to correct us, to bring us along toward the completion and the fulfillment of his will in our lives. Now that might bring to mind some questions that are difficult to answer. Are we to believe that every disappointment, every difficulty, every time something doesn't work out the way we wanted it to, is something that God directly caused to happen? The answer to that would be no, it's not. God works with the circumstances that take place in our lives to use those circumstances for us to learn and for us to to grow. We have free will, by the way. And even though God's will is one thing, He gives us the responsibility to choose what we will do. So we can choose to make mistakes. We can choose to make our lives complicated. But if we remember that God is in charge, if we remember that His will is more important than ours and we submit ourselves to it, then as we make our plans, then we will be allowing God to work His plan in our lives as well. So when you look ahead to the next several years, the next 10 years or so into the future, make those plans as if you're going to live a full life, but also remember that ultimately God is in charge, and we are in His hands, and He will guide us through our lives to fulfill His will. Another important principle about planning. When we think about, say, the next 10 years, we need to consider the times we live in today. We need to take into account the world that we live in. Turn with me back to Isaiah chapter 30. You know, most of the time when we think we project ourselves into the future, we tend to think of the future being having the same elements or being just like today, except we're older. But the truth is that we live in a world that is changing. We live in a world that is fragile. A world, a society where things are unstable. And if we pin all of our hopes on the world being like it is today, 10 years from now, then we're probably going to be very disappointed. Isaiah chapter 30, verse 14. I'm sorry, verse 12. Isaiah chapter 30, verse 12. This, of course, we're breaking into a thought here where the nation of Israel is being warned warned of punishment that may come upon them. Isaiah 30, verse 12, "Therefore, thus says the Holy One of Israel, because you despise this word and trust in oppression and perversity." Now, we can view this as God's message to the world around us, the world we live in. Because we are practicing God's way of life, and this is the world around us. This is the way the world is. "Because you despise the word of God, you trust in oppression and perversity and rely on them, therefore this iniquity shall be to you like a breach ready to fall, a bulge in a high wall whose breaking comes down suddenly in an instant." You see, we live in a society that is on the wrong side of a wall that's about to collapse. There's a breach, there's a bulge in the wall. And it's going to come down, it's going to crash down in an instant. And it says in verse 14, it will break the nation like a piece of pottery. It's broken in pieces. We live, to try to put this more clearly, we live in a world, in a society that's very fragile, that seems to be continuing along in a way that's stable. People go to work every day, they make money, they come home, they go to movies on the weekend, they go to their baseball games. They live their lives not knowing that the wall is about to collapse, that the bulge is starting to be forced out more and more. The weakness is there. We live in a world that seems to be stable. An example, what happened to all the fear about the U.S. economy? Right now, everybody's too worried about scandals to focus much on the reality of how fragile our society, our economy is. Our economy is doing pretty well, but do you know why? Because our government keeps printing the funny money. The money that we're living on, that's keeping our society stable and prosperous and keeping people busy and happy, isn't real. And someday, that wall is going to collapse. Someday, that economy is going to come crashing down around this nation's ears. But people don't pay attention to that. Somehow, we passed $15 trillion in national debt, and now we're closing in on 17, and it doesn't seem to matter that much anymore because the stock market is way up. What's keeping our economy going, what's keeping our society stable, quote unquote, is smoke and mirrors. It's not truth. It's not reality. Someday this wall is going to crash, and it's going to land on people who aren't aware of it, who aren't expecting it. So as we make our plans for the future, we need to keep in mind that things can change very quickly. And we cannot pin all of our hope on what we think of as being a stable environment that's all around us. There are so many different aspects of life that could really become a serious problem. Think about the possibility of terrorists and what they can do, acting either individually or as a group. Think about these rogue nations. I think that's kind of a polite way of saying nations with morons for leaders, that have weapons. They could unleash the North Koreas and the Irans and the Syrias. You know, everything that seems so stable could easily and quickly collapse. And as maybe unpleasant as it might be, we need to consider that as we make our plans for the future, to recognize the times in which we live. Matthew 24, verse 36. Matthew 24, 36. You recognize Matthew 24, the Olivet prophecy. Jesus was asked by his disciples to tell them what would be the signs of the end of the age and of his return. We're breaking into toward the end of that prophecy in verse 36. Speaking of his return, Jesus says that of that day and hour no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, but my Father only. As we make our plans for the next 10 years, we cannot decide that, well, about 8.5 years into it, Jesus is going to return. We don't know when he's going to return. We don't know. The society we live in, the balloon that's growing larger and larger, someday is going to pop, representing the stability of our nation. We don't know how big, how elastic that can be. Maybe things will continue. Maybe things won't. We do know that there are some events happening around us that show us that times are not stable. But no one knows just when all these end-time events are going to begin in their full force. Verse 37, but as the days of Noah, here's one thing that Jesus says is a sign of what those of when that will happen at that end of that period of time, at the end of that age, at this age. As the days of Noah were, so also will be the coming of the Son of Man. For as in the days before the flood, they were eating, drinking, marrying, and giving in marriage until the day that Noah entered the ark. And they did not know until the flood came and took them all away. So also will the coming of the Son of Man be. We have a real distinct advantage. We do not need to live as these folks did in the times of Noah. Now, it was an evil age, but the point that I think Jesus is making here is that they were oblivious to what was going to happen. Didn't give it any thought. They didn't recognize what was going to happen in their future. As we make our plans, as we consider what we want to accomplish, our education, our careers, our plans for our families, we keep in mind that this world we live in is very fragile. This world that we live in is not something that is stable. And we don't put all of our hopes in what we see around us. The people around us are not going to understand the events as they unfold. We can. Of course, it's going to take effort on our part to be able to. But we need to keep in mind the times in which we live as we make our plans for the future. Make your plans, set out to accomplish them, but remember what time it is. Mark chapter 13, verse 32. Mark 13 is a parallel to Matthew 24. Includes the same prophecy. It's Mark's version or recording of that Olivet prophecy. Mark 13, 32 says, "But of that day and hour no one knows, not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but only the Father." Same thing we read in Matthew, that the timetable is in God's hand. As far as when end time events will occur, when they will begin, how they will unfold, it's in the God is in charge of that schedule. Verse 33, here's what we can do. Three things. Take heed, watch, and pray. Jesus gives us three steps that we can take as we consider the times in which we live. To take heed means to be aware of or to watch out for. As we plan our lives and go about our lives, we are aware of, we're watching out for these events that show how fragile our society is. That wall, that bulge in the wall, is something that we notice and we're aware of and we take into account as we make our plans. So we're aware of, we're watching out for. Secondly, he says to watch. To watch. To watch in the Greek literally means to not sleep. To be awake at all times. Well, we can't do that physically, humanly. We need our sleep. So the application of the word is that we are to be alert, vigilant. That we're not to become distracted. That we're not to take our eyes off of what's really happening. So we make our plans for our future realistically, taking into account that we may well have time to accomplish a great deal and to accomplish many plans that we set out to do. But on the other hand, realistically, we know the times in which we live, and things can change very quickly. And of course, third, Jesus said, take heed, watch, and then number three, pray. Pray. As Paul wrote in 1 Thessalonians 5, pray without ceasing. Or as I've often rephrased it, never don't pray. Always pray. We need to have strength in our minds, in our lives, in order to have the discernment so that we'll understand, so that we'll see what is happening. As we take heed and as we watch, then we also pray for understanding, for discernment, so that we will have the strength that we need to remain vigilant and alert. Certainly there's nothing more important in our lives than prayer in terms of the context, the proximity we need to have with the Father, with Jesus Christ, in order to have that vision of what's happening in the world around us. We need to see that world. Luke 21, we might as well take a look at all three of these accounts here of the Olivet prophecy. Luke 21 adds another thought. Verse 34, Jesus again, in the same message, the same prophecy about the end of the age, Jesus says, take heed to yourselves. So, in other words, be aware and be consistent in your approach to watch out for and to think about the way that you live. Take heed to yourself so that you don't get wrapped up in things that will distract you. The plans we make don't have to be contradictory to God's will. Some people do, but if we are careful, then we will make plans that will allow us to continue to be aware of the times in which we live and not become distracted from them. So watch in verse 36 and pray always. Always pray. Prayer is that necessary ingredient in our relationship that will enable us to have the perception we need, because we need to understand the times in which we live. And as we think about our future, as we make our plans, then we know that God is ultimately in charge, and we also remember the age in which we live and that things can change very suddenly. So what's the use? If this whole world is going to come crashing down around our ears anyway, then why make any plans? What's the point of it? Well, that would bring us, I hope, to a third point. Something else to keep in mind as we make our plans for the next 10 years, we make our plans for our future. That is to keep in mind the times that are to come. Keep in mind the times that are to come. You know, in the sample prayer, Jesus told his disciples to pray, "Thy kingdom come." Why do we pray for the kingdom? If we have our plans and we have things we want to accomplish and goals we'd like to succeed at, why do we pray for the kingdom? Why do you pray for the kingdom? I really can't tell you why you should want the kingdom to come. That's something that each one of us has to come to understand for ourselves. When I was 16, my family was in the church, and I was learning some of these same principles, and I have to be real candid. I prayed for the kingdom to come. Kinda. I kinda wanted the kingdom to come. What I really wanted was to grow up. What I really wanted was to be able to finish high school and go to college and find the most beautiful woman in the world and marry her, which I did. But I had thoughts and dreams and goals for my life. And when I was 16, I learned some of these same principles. And I could realize, I could accept in a conceptual way that God's kingdom was better. But when we're young, we want to enjoy and to experience life. That's only natural. But as we grow, as we mature, our perspective does change. We become sensitive to, we become aware of the agony and the chaos in this world. We realize that this world doesn't have the answers, and that this world is not going to provide the stability and the foundation that we are looking for in our own lives. So we can certainly build our lives on God's way, and we can experience the blessings of God as we live in this society, because we're called out of it, we're called to be part of God's way of life. But for the sake of the world, for the sake of mankind, that kingdom needs to come. The Apostle John wrote in 1 John 2 that we should not love the world or the things of the world, because all those things will pass away. what we're looking to build in our lives is something that will not end when this age ends, but that we can take with us into the future. And we can have a vision of what the age to come will be like for mankind. Let's look at, I asked you to consider 10 years into the future. Let's build on that. Let's think about 1,000 years into the future. Turn to Amos chapter 9. The 9th chapter of Amos. This appears to be sometime well into the millennium, because it will take time for these kinds of changes to take effect. But this is a world that's so different from the world that we live in now. As we think about the world we live in now and see how our plans, our goals, our desires really can be fulfilled in a different age and different time than now, we see why that new world needs to be established. And it gives us a better vision of what the future can be like, what the future will be like. Amos 9, verse 13. "Behold, the days are coming, says the Lord." Now, that's simply a promise. God says this is going to happen. And this is a vision. This is something that God has in his plan that he will accomplish. And it will occur. "These days are going to happen, when the plowman shall overtake the reaper, and the treader of grapes overtakes him who sows seed." In other words, there'll be a time when this world is so prosperous that the harvest season is going to overlap into the planting season, that there'll be more than can be gathered before it's time to plant again. We don't live in an agricultural society, but I think we can relate that to other forms of wealth that we are familiar with. There just will be more than is possible to use in terms of wealth. "The mountains shall drip with sweet wine, and all the hills will flow with it." Again, healthy grape-producing vineyards are a symbol of wealth and of prosperity. The nation here, and this is speaking specifically of Israel, and then it goes to the rest of the world from there, the world will benefit, and the world will be changed. The world will have true wealth, not funny money, but true wealth and stability. "I'll bring back the captives of my people Israel. Now that's an implication of some of the difficult times that are ahead. The nation will be punished. That's part of our understanding of the future. But God will bring back those that had been punished, and they will be put into and given this prosperity. "They shall build the waste cities and inhabit them." Talk about an infrastructure project. "They will rebuild the cities, and they will be established in a time of security. They'll plant vineyards and drink wine from them." If you read back earlier in the other prophecies here in Isaiah and Jeremiah in particular, Israel is warned many times that they would plant vineyards, but then their enemies would come in and take the fruit from those vineyards. This is a description of stability. This is a description of of prosperity. Description of a time when people will be settled and secure. "I will plant them in their land, and no longer shall they be pulled up from the land I've given them, says the Lord." Can we even imagine a world, if we're trying to project ourselves into the future, can we imagine a world where all the children are safe and happy and secure? Where all of their parents have learned to love each other and to care for and train and teach their children properly. Where all of the teens and young adults have learned morality and respect for themselves and for each other. A society where you can plan a career and a marriage and a family based on a stable society, in a world that is filled with meaning. We've learned to live in this world. And we do the best we can. We can apply God's way. We can train our children. We can have happy marriages ourselves. We can learn morality and respect ourselves. But how about a world where that's the way life is? How about a world that will be based on, as Isaiah described it, the knowledge of God that fills the earth as the waters cover the seas? That promise of a world to come is just as certain as you waking up tomorrow morning. It will happen. We have an opportunity to be part of it. We can dream about it, we can imagine it for now, but that time is coming. So as we think about our plans for our lives living in this world, which is unstable and insecure, we also keep in mind the time that God has promised, the time that is yet to come. A world that will be so much different from today that there really is no comparison. So where will you be? What will your life be like 10 years from now? None of us really can say for sure. But we do have some hopes. We do have some plans. We do have some goals. And we should walk into our future optimistically. Because we know that it is God's will to strengthen and to establish His people and those who look to Him. And we know it is God's will to work in our lives so that we will succeed. And we know that it is God's will to establish His society for all of mankind in His kingdom. So we should walk into our future with great optimism. And at the same time, walk into the immediate future realistically. Carefully, understanding that for now, we do live in a dangerous and evil world. We cannot pin our hopes, our desires, our future on this evil world. Difficult times have already begun. Difficult times will undoubtedly become more intense in the coming years. Certainly in the next 10 years. We don't know exactly what our future holds. But whether you're 15 or 85, the lesson I'm trying to emphasize today is the same. Plan and live realistically and optimistically. Because this is the time of your life.